Welcome, everyone, to episode 322 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we have a very special episode generated from a listener, actually, who proposed the idea of walking through some recent rebuilds, and we're going to try to figure out if there is, quote-unquote, a right way to rebuild in the NBA. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. In our bio, you can find our Twitter handles, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. And we are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today, as always, is my co-host Morten Jensen, who also believes that Luka Doncic has already reached his peak. Mort, how's it going?
I absolutely refuse to answer your question right now. I am so pissed. I am so frustrated. As soon as I saw that quote, I went to Forbes and I wrote an angry piece.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah.
I was upset. That was not cool. Here's the thing, right? This bothers me tremendously. So the kid comes over from Real Madrid. He's won the European Championship, not for Real Madrid, but for Slovenia. But he's also won the EuroLeague title. He's won multiple league titles in Spain. He comes over and you have some people basically saying, oh, he should go 12th. I don't know that Rashad Phillips dude himself Yoda or whatever. I don't know. But like, oh, he should be a second round pick. Like, okay, first and foremost, that was dumb. He was always going to be a star. So drafted number one. Then he wins Rookie of the Year and people go, well, I don't really know how much better he's going to be. All right, next year, this year, he goes out and almost averages a 30-point triple-double. And then you have the doubters once again. Like, you know what? Maybe he's not going to... Shut up. Just, like, you're all just going to look so dumb. And here's the thing, right? If this came from an Eastern Conference executive, now I kind of get why the East always suck. If that's the way they look at talent, then I get why the East suck.
Like, I just want to know not gonna take him. Which executive, like which team it was. I don't even care which executive, but which team was it and did it rhyme with the Schmidt-Lana Hawks? I feel like it had to.
Thank you.
It had to be. You know,
that was the first one, right?
Yeah. Or like, I'm terrified though, because like, what if it's the Sixers? Like, oh, Jesus.
I mean, that could be a thing. But you know what? It is what it is. So let me just, before we introduce our guest, well, you know what? Let's do that right away. TJ, how are you? TJ McBride, come on, man. It's been
so
a while.
Livid, it's more. I can't even have this conversation. I spent 18 months of my life having this exact argument on Twitter up until he was finally drafted, and then he proceeds to just literally become an MVP candidate overnight after playing in the second toughest league in the world as a teenager, and just handled everything, and now everyone wants to continually talk crap because Eastern Europeans do not look like the perfect NBA player that you would build in a laboratory, so there's just no way that they're going to be able to do anything, despite the fact that the guy without athleticism dunked on the Nuggets and almost beat them with that dunk with seconds left in the fourth quarter, despite the fact that his non-shooting and all of his pull-up shots all fell this year, and despite the fact that his playmaking is one of the elite levels in basketball already. So It's infuriating. I can't have this conversation because I get angry immediately, and here I am yelling within 30 seconds of this podcast.
That's perfect. Let me ask you something. Are you an American?
Yes, I am an American.
All right. I'm a European, obviously. So here's the thing. When I said the same things that you did on Twitter, people were calling me out saying I was biased for obvious reasons, i.e. that I'm European, so I had some sort of stake in this. I'm just glad to get this out of the way that you, an American, can also share this sentiment. Because that whole sentiment, you know, the other one about Luka having peaked or somehow not getting better, you know, we've stopped swearing on this podcast. So we can just bleep the next 30 seconds out of it. But it's really dumb. It's really dumb is kind of my point. And I'm livid. I'm still livid.
That was going to be my point. It's not sentiment. It's complete and utter ignorance. And people who refuse to look at it completely in front of their face and obvious and easy. That was one of the single easiest projections from a scouting point of view that has existed in the last decade plus. Full stop.
Here's the thing, right? Because of what he did in Europe, even though he was such a young age, and what he's done internationally, you could argue that if somehow, and knock on wood, this never happens, but if like his right leg fell off and his basketball days were over, you could make the argument that he's a Hall of Famer.
I mean, internationally, there is an argument there. And that thing people miss. They hear Hall of Fame, they're like, but he didn't play in the NBA for more. It's not about that. Like, there's a reason Carmelo Anthony is a bona fide first team Hall of Famer, and it's because all the gold medals in the Olympics that he had. That is his best resume builder for being able to get into the Olympics. He's an incredible all-time great scorer at the position that he played in the time that he played, but it's the gold medals that put him into that Hall of Fame contention without any question whatsoever. So I actually, that's a fascinating question, and I'm slightly leaning to agreeing with you.
Yeah, as you should. Just as you should have called me the winner in the last visit you had.
I don't call anybody the winner except for Brian, apparently.
Yeah, well, TJ, I'm just shocked to hear you defend a fat white European. This is very unlike you.
I've never gotten used to this. It's not like this isn't something that happens too often on Twitter for me.
Right. Well, thank you again for joining us. Before we get into this rebuild idea, please let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work.
Yes, at TJ McBride NBA on Twitter, where I usually tweet far too often, but recently it's just been Star Wars and hip-hop that I'm tweeting about. But past that, go subscribe to the Rocky Mountain Hoops podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, and go to milehighsports.com and read whatever you want about Colorado sports.
There you go. Yeah, please give TJ a follow. Always great. Great work the whole year round, and if and when basketball comes back, allegedly it will at some point, the Nuggets are going to be very relevant. So we wanted to get into this because a user on Twitter, Jordan Scott, his handle is JordanDan53, hit us up a couple weeks ago and kind of suggested comparing and contrasting the Nuggets and the 76ers rebuilds that they've done in the past couple years, and then that got me thinking, like, well, we'll do that today for sure, but I want to like expand it because, you know, teams are rebuilding all the time. And I'm wondering if there are certain things that all rebuilding teams either should or shouldn't do. So we're going to deep dive into the Nuggets and the Sixers just because they are so contrasting in the past couple of years. And then we'll hit a couple other teams that have either been rebuilding willfully or have just kind of been stuck in purgatory for a long time and figure out what has and hasn't worked and like what these teams should be doing moving forward. So TJ, since you're the guest, we'll start with the Nuggets. You know, obviously, I think if we're looking for lessons to replicate moving forward for other teams, find an MVP candidate with the 41st overall pick is not one that we could easily replicate. But what, you know, so they got Jokic, of course, at 41 in 2014, and that has propelled them in large part to the heights where they are. He's, you know, a legit MVP candidate, the best player on the team, but that isn't the only reason the Nuggets have gotten good. So what about their rebuild over the last couple of years has worked in your eyes?
It's going to sound crazy, but I'm going to go all the way back to 2013, 7 years ago. This was essentially the start of what is this current Nuggets front office. Of course, now Arturis Karnišovas is over in Chicago, so that's a little bit different, but that's where this current iteration of the Nuggets franchise begins. And at that point, the Nuggets had struck out with free agents, have not had enough top-end talent to get past the first round of the playoffs, had lost Melo to a, you know, premier big market city, and they felt stuck. They no longer knew how to be able to traverse this NBA world to give themselves the best shot, not at just making the playoffs and going far, but actually winning a title, which has seemed so far-fetched for everybody who's ever been a Nuggets fan. So what they did is they tore it all down. We're going to start at the most core basic level of how you rebuild a team, and that's the draft. Tim Connelly was not a high-level executive. He was not a common household name. He was not somebody who had done 19 different things throughout the league with 4 different teams and had a stint in the league office. He was a scout. Full stop. That is what he did. He was a director of player personnel in New Orleans who was never in New Orleans because he was always gone scouting. Even now in Denver, he'll just disappear for 2 weeks because he's just out scouting. It's who he is to his core. So the Nuggets decided, we're going to completely restart this. We're going to rebuild our entire organization from the top all the way down to the 17th man on the roster. And they did that. So they drafted not just for top-tier talent, but they focused on the second round. They looked for helpful role players in the middle of the first round. They only had a top 7 pick twice in that entire process of being able to rebuild the team. And it all goes back to the fact that they prioritized scouting, which is something the Bulls are doing under Arturis as well. They prioritized prioritize the type of players they wanted to build a culture, which are high IQ guys, no drama guys. You're not going to have all of these different, you know, potentials for whether it's suspensions due to drug charges or whatever domestic violence happens to other players over there. They were not going to have it. They put a line in the sand and they said, if you can't meet this moral requirement of how we're going to run our culture and our organization, you don't fit. So they started moving. They started completely rebuilding. Gary Harris is the longest tenured player on the Denver Nuggets roster. They completely tore it to pieces. And it started with scouting, and it started with the basis of what they wanted their culture to be. And the second most important thing was hiring Michael Malone, a head coach who could actually build that foundation of a culture. Because the front office can only put schemes and ideas and philosophies into place. You need somebody who can completely tear up the ground and reset it themselves. And Michael Malone was the perfect coach for that. So when I look at what the Nuggets were able to do and what other teams didn't do during their rebuild, they didn't just rebuild their roster. They rebuilt their coaching staff. They rebuilt their front office, and they rebuilt the way that ownership interacts with the front office, with the coaching staff, for what they now call their alignment top to bottom, which is really what they hang their hat on as an organization. Everybody works together. None of that existed. They had to destroy it all, and that's the credit that I give them for being able to architect what is arguably the most successful rebuild in the past 10-20 years of basketball.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at their draft history, even dating back to 2014, they had the 11 pick, they picked Doug McDermott, flip that to Chicago, get Gary Harris and Yusuf Nurkic, they get Jokic in 41. So 2014 sets the foundation for this thing. They don't hit on every pick, and they don't hit on every draft night move, which we can get into, because we'll, like, numbered. Yeah, 2015, they get Moutier at 7, which, you know, he was high on the boards, but didn't work out for them. But then 2016, Jamal Murray at 7, Juan Hernan Gomez at 15, Malik Beasley at 19. All of those guys panned out. 2017 was the one big misstep where they had the Donovan Mitchell pick, traded it to Utah, but they still find Monte Morris in the second round at number 51. So the, you know, 2017 draft isn't a total disaster for them. And then 2018, they take the home run swing on Michael Porter Jr. at 14. He misses his whole rookie season with the back injury. It's a high risk, high reward pick, but the talent is there. You see it in flashes this year. So, you know, Denver has an extremely promising young core because, as you said, they've done well to build through the draft, hit more than they've missed. I think it's fair to say, despite, you know, the Mitchell thing hurts, but it wasn't a total organization deal breaker because they have so many other Jokic and Murray and all these other guys that they hit on. So, I mean, I think that's definitely, you know, for all of the teams that are rebuilding or starting to rebuild, like, valuing the draft should absolutely be the first step, right? I mean, like, you're not going to bring in talent unless there is talent on your team already. You're not going to sign a marquee free agent if you don't have promising young guys. Like, what made the Nets attractive to Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving? Sean Marks built through the draft through a couple of years, despite not really having the resources to do so. He just also hit on a number of picks, Caris LeVert, Jared Allen, you know, landing Spencer Dinwiddie and Joe Harris and all those guys. So, yeah, I mean, I think that more than anything, like, the Nuggets should be commended for, you know, really, like, they didn't, as you said, they didn't have to tank for high picks. They just nailed the ones more often than not than that they had.
And they didn't ever decide that they were going to just immediately sign whoever they could sign at any free agency point. That is one of the most important parts of this particular discussion, is they were able to keep all of that flexibility to sign a guy like Paul Millsap when they needed to because of the contracts that of keeping players that you drafted. Plus, we are not talking about the trades. Like, when they went and got Malik Beasley and they got that Rockets first round pick, that goes back to when they traded Ty Lawson to the Rockets and got that first round pick. Oh no, sorry, Aaron Aflalo. They sent Aaron Aflalo to the Rockets. They got a first round pick back and Will Barton in that deal. So again, it's not the big flashy names. It's not ever going to be the Nuggets sign Kevin Durant. It's, wow, they found the ideal role players to fit what they were doing. And also, another part of the scouting thing, which I think is overlooked in a dramatic way, is how many connections the Nuggets had around the world. The way they found Torrey Craig was Pat Connaughton Connolly, who also went with Arturis to Chicago, was currently working in the NBL in Australia, saw Torrey Craig, called his brother, they invited him to Summer League, and here he is, becoming a starter for 11 playoff games last season. Those things, those small decisions, drafting Monte Morris, finding a guy like Vlatko Chanchar who can play four positions and costs you $2 million, being able to identify players like that, it gives you such a competitive edge in so many different realms. And I think that's a massive part of this. And it's a big reason why the Bulls have been making such a big public event of making their scouting department bigger, expanding their international circuits. And I tell this story a lot. Nikola Jokic would have never been in Denver if it wasn't for the fact that Arturis Karnišovis went to Real Madrid, watched Nikola Jokic have the worst game of his life. Nikola Jokic proceeded to almost choose to sign with Real Madrid and not go into the NBA, and Arturis convinced him not to. Without that, none of this exists. The Nuggets' ascension to the top of the Western, none of it exists in any capacity. The Nuggets had enough people on the ground in so many different corners of the world that they were able to identify talents with the potential to grow into the players that they are. That is something that so few teams take advantage of, and it's something that I think you're going to see a lot more of going down the line.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes total sense. So I was mentioning this before we started recording, but Mort and I just finished this like top off-season questions for every team. We just had the Nuggets the last episode, and Mort brought up I thought was a pretty interesting point about, you know, the Nuggets have had all of these young guys on their roster, and at a certain point when their rookie contracts run out, you either need to extend them or trade them. They chose the trade route with Beasley and Hernan Gomez at this past year's trade deadline. So where do you think the Nuggets go from here? Like, did they miss their window for that next big upgrade? Do they even need that? Or can they just, you know, hope that Michael Porter Jr., like, maybe they already have a big three in-house. It's just, you know, these guys are all so young that, like, we need another year or two, and then Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. take that step.
It's so hard to say because Malik Beasley's value was so polarizing around the league. It's so clear that when you have a hyper-athletic, 6'5", can play multiple positions on the floor, somebody who can just shoot the lights out of the ball, that's a very enticing kind of a player, but he was so lackadaisical defensively. He was so unaware of what is happening around him on a court that there were so many red flags to go with all of the good sides of it. So when you talk about trading these guys, and if you did it too late and if it closed a window, I first of all find it very difficult to say either way with the current state of the league, but also I don't know if Malik Beasley or Wancho were either good enough to be a part of a bigger deal. I mean, they went out there, they moved guys to an environment that they wanted to be in. They needed to get the addition by subtraction of getting Michael Porter Jr. more minutes. They went and got a player like Kata Bates-Jopp who was able to fill a lot of different roles on the court. So that deal, I don't know if you're going to get much of a better deal for those kinds of players, even if you go back farther, because again, they are so polarizing. When players like that are so polarizing, you just don't give up the farm for them, even if they are an exciting, enticing prospect. The other side of this, though, of the window closing, I think it's fascinating because teams get stale quickly in the NBA. This Nuggets team has been together for 5 years. They're still the second youngest roster in all of basketball. The idea of this window being closing right now, it's so hard to wrap my head around it because they're 22, 23, 24 years old. Like, the reality is that they're only 60% of what they can be at their peaks right now. So I don't know if the window's closed. I don't know how much longer it's going to be open, again, because of the uncertainty of the league. But I think the idea that this window is closing quickly is something that is completely beyond me because, again, like you pointed out, Michael Porter Jr. is waiting in the wings. And when you look at what he was able to do this season, even in minimal, infrequent minutes, he's one of, like, 11 players in NBA history to put up those per 36 as a rookie. Like, you just don't see players that versatile. And then we haven't even talked about Jamal Murray, who's averaging 25-5 as a 23-year-old. Like, that's a pretty wild thing to think about despite all of the other issues that exist in Jamal Murray's game. So what if it really is just 2 years away still? I know I'm sick of saying that, but at what point could they actually be just 2 years away from being that level of a team?
Right.
I think it was built on the premise that we were looking at the team. We know that Gary Harris has gone through a lot of lower body injuries. And obviously, like that's been more or less 2 years with him struggling in terms of the injuries. Yeah, exactly. So there's a question mark about how he'll be able to regain his touch and his rhythm and whether he can stay healthy long enough moving forward. Then at the same time, we look at Jamal Murray, who sort of stagnated this mm-hmm. year. We don't dispute the fact that he's good. Clearly he is. But I think at this level, considering this was his this is fourth year in the league, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think at this point, we were kind of hoping to see maybe a little bit more consistent long-range shooting because, you know, his mechanics are just so damn
solid. They're perfect.
Yeah. So it's just weird that he's, like, hovering around, like, the 35% area. And I think for our part, we were sitting there going, well, those guys are being locked up financially now with Jokic and all that. At some point, that roster, from a financial perspective, is going to be somewhat
set. We're there. We're 100% there because this is the thing. Jamal Murray has signed a maximum contract extension last summer that kicks in this summer. Jeremy Grant's right. $9 million player option's up, and he's going to want like $17 million probably. Paul Millsap is going to be an unrestricted free agent this season, and you're going to want to keep him. Nikola Jokic is already on a max. You're already paying $20 million to Gary Harris, $18 million to Will Barton. They're maxed out. Like, you're talking about them being up at above the cap with nine dudes right now. Yes. So they're already
locked in.
And that's
the window we're talking about. Yes. That's why we talk about like window, not in terms of the window won't stay open for the competitiveness, because obviously, like you alluded to, the ages of these players, they're so young that of course there's going to be internal improvement. The window is more or less, you know, the line of thought that can you get someone from the outside that you can add to this group that may be, you know, that crucial piece that brings them over the top.
For sure. And you have Bradley Beal and Jrue Holiday as mentioned in that ilk,
right,
for sure.
Exactly.
But what I wonder is, are the Nuggets ownership group going to be willing to spend into the tax enough to do this? They moved Wilson Chandler to the 76ers with the pure intention of avoiding the luxury tax that season. And they could have used him, despite the fact that there were internal struggles between Wilson and the organization, and the season didn't go the way that they wanted, and a whole lot of other things. But they sold Gallo and Wilson away, full stop. And they did not need to do that. And when you look at this Nuggets team right now, could you imagine Gallinari at the three? Like, could you just, like, think about how good that team could be in that circumstance? But again, they sold those guys away. And that's something that will close your window quicker than any injury, quicker than any age, quicker than any financial situation. If you're not willing to spend, you're not going to get there. And all of these players, by the way, Nuggets have bird rights on all of them. They could keep everyone if they wanted to. I have no faith they will, but they could keep this window open for a long time. I just have very little faith that they do.
Yeah. So when I'm thinking of takeaways here to apply to other teams, I think the tax issue is a huge one for any team. Like, if your ownership is willing to pay the tax, that's going to be such a competitive advantage when you have guys like Tillman Fertitta around who, like, every year, you know, have a team that could have won a title in the last 3 years. And every year it's, oh, the trade deadline's here. We magically got under the tax. What a total coincidence. So it's like, okay, guy. Like
you're $101,000 under the tax and a $180 million salary cap. Like, that seems to be on purpose.
right. Sure, it's a coincidence every single time. And I'm sure the depth of your roster was not an issue at any point in the playoffs. But, you know, so like I look at the Clippers, right, where Steve Ballmer is just so filthy rich that I think he's going to be willing to pay wildly into the tax, and that's going to give the Clippers such an advantage. Like, if they're willing to spend $20 million this summer to retain Montrezl Harrell and just say, we don't care, like, that's a gigantic advantage. So that, for any team, not even rebuilding, but championship contenders as well, if your ownership is willing to pay well into the tax, because it goes up very quickly, once you get, like, $15, $20 million over, it starts to be extremely punitive. That's going to be a huge deal. And then, I mean, I think the idea of windows, not from the competitive standpoint, but more, as you were saying, from the financial perspective of, you know, these guys are on rookie contracts for 4 years. You can re-sign them. If they're good enough, you're going to sign them to a max or a near max contract. Once you get two or three of those on the books, it becomes a lot harder. You know, like, at the very start of a rebuild, if you look at, like, where Memphis is right now, Memphis is sitting pretty. Because you've got Jaren Jackson Jr. on a rookie deal, John Moran on a rookie deal, Brandon Clark on a rookie deal. But once those start coming up, and once you start having Jaren Jackson Jr. on the $30-plus million deal, John Moran on a max deal, all of a sudden that flexibility is gone. And you're kind of locked into, not necessarily locked into, I mean, you can trade some of these guys, but, like, you don't have the, oh, we could add this superstar, and, you know, sign whoever, trade whoever, it just becomes a lot more difficult to make big changes.
And I'm so curious what happened with Jamal Murray now, because I agree with Mort. The three-point shooting not being there like it should is massively concerning for me. If the three-point shooting does not get there, and he's still turnover prone, and he still struggles just getting the ball into the post, what does that contract look like in 18 months? Does he start getting the Andrew Wiggins treatment of, yeah, he's talented, but hell no, I'm not touching that contract. Like, we're getting towards that point. And again, Jamal Murray is probably a more impactful player than Andrew Wiggins is right now. I'm not trying to, like, compare the two players, but the way that the contract is going to create this perspective of each of them, if Jamal Murray becomes untradeable and not worth that max, the Nuggets might be screwed. Like, it's that simple, and it seems so trivial to kind of, like, bring it down to something that simplistic, but it's very true. You can't bring back Jeremy Grant all of a sudden. You can't have Paul Millsap on the bench. You can't get a Torrey Craig to fill out your bench. You can't all of a sudden give Michael Porter Jr. the contract that he may want if you keep Jamal Murray around once you get to that point. Like, these questions become very concerning because you're not getting enough from him, and I'm very concerned about that. And going back to your previous point about owners being willing to spend, the Rockets are my favorite example, because when Leslie Alexander owned that team, he just outright bought like 17 players to trade to get Chris Paul on that team. They proceeded to go to game 7 against the Warriors and almost beat one of the greatest dynasties ever because he was willing to spend. He gave up probably, what, $12 million in just useless, unguaranteed salary to be able to build that trade, just to have that, you know, that opportunity to compete. And then, when they were at that high evaluation, he sold and walked and was like, good luck, this is, I'm now out. I did everything I could, and I'm now out. But that's the advantage. Look at the Rockets now compared to when they were actually competing with the Warriors. That is the easiest example for me to show.
Yeah, totally.
All right, so we can determine one thing then. Having an ownership group that is willing to spend is a crucial element in the rebuilding process. I agree with that, obviously. But I think, you know, these examples just are a pretty nice way to set everything up, because you need to have the long-term view. When you as an organization start, you know, when you make that decision, we got to start over. We got to clean house. We got to get guys in. You can't just look at the draft and think 1 year ahead. You need to think long term. You need to have a plan in place. You have to understand, you know what, in 4 years, even if we hit home, let's say we have three first round draft picks in a single year, theoretically, even if we hit on all three, in 4 years, those three guys are going to be up, and that could be $90 million right there. So we have to factor in, you know, the salary structure. We have to figure in, you know, if we have enough money, if we deem it that we have enough money to go out and be free agency players at some point during this process before we lock those guys up. I think it's an interesting dynamic that every team has to think about. But yeah, so let's cross that off our list. One thing to be a not guaranteed a good rebuild, but certainly something that would help your odds, is having an ownership group that's willing to spend.
Yeah,
for sure.
The long-term planning, Mort, I think is a good way to transition into the Sixers, because that's what made Sam Hinkie so appealing. You know, you fast forward or rewind back to 2013, 2014, the Sixers had just gone all in on Andrew Bynum. That went bust. They had just given up so much. Drew Holiday,
that
Mo
was
Harkless.
Only 7 years ago.
I know. I swear to God, I mean,
Andrew Bynum
like,
feels like 15 years ago.
Yeah,
sorry,
we're all
I didn't mean to cut
dog
you off.
Years. No. It's you know, like,
let me make it even worse. So Sam Hinkie has been away from the Sixers longer than he actually was employed.
Yeah. Wait, really?
Yeah, oh, he was God. Only there for 3 years.
Jeez,
and he's been gone for four.
Yeah,
I don't need that's insane to me. But sorry, continue your point. I did not mean to distract all of a sudden.
No, you're good. Well, I mean, so you know, the Sixers had given up so much, got nothing in return. It was a gamble they had, you know, they just decided to go all in and say, if this busts, then we're bringing in the guy to tear it all down. And Sam Hinkie comes in and says, this is going to be painful, it's going to take a couple of years. That's great. Everyone gets on board because he's at least communicating. You know, he decides to build through the draft, but unlike the Nuggets, he's like, man, we got nothing in the cupboard. Like, we just traded everything. So we have to get rid of, we're going to trade Drew Holiday, and we're going to pick up Nerlens, and we got another pick that they used. They ended up flipping to get Dario Saric. We're going to just build through the draft, but we're going to tank. We're going to shamelessly tank for a couple of years, because the easiest way to find a superstar is at the top of the draft. And Ultimately, they end up getting Joel Embiid at number three because he falls because of the back injury that gets discovered right before, or it was the foot injury that gets discovered right before the draft. They win the lottery 2 years later and get Ben Simmons. So, you know, in the most base way, if you're saying all Sam Hinkie did was tank for superstars, he got two of them. So that was success. He did not hit on every pick. The Nerlens won. You know, Nerlens is a good player, but that, you know, the whole 2013 draft is...
Yeah, Jahlil Okafor coming up next, and the same... Yeah, I know. Dude, I've never been so... I've never been so sure that someone was just not going to fit in the NBA that was a top 10 pick. I've never been more sure than that.
Yeah, and we had Yaron Weitzman on, who the author of Tanking at the Top, the recent book on the process Sixers, and he answered my long-standing question was, like, did Josh Harris have a gun in Sam Hinkie's mouth during that draft? And was he saying, if you submit anyone's name other than Jahlil Okafor, I'm going to shoot you? Because it was just such an anti-Hinkie pick at the time. But yes. No, I mean, your own said, like, look, based on my reporting, Sam was just kind of going, like, quote-unquote, best player available. Kristaps was giving them the runaround leading up to the draft, and he thought, like, well, maybe, you know, at least Jahlil will be able to trade him. But he didn't see... you know, the evolution of the league that the Warriors were bringing at the time, where guys like Jahlil would quickly become irrelevant. So they, you know, they did not hit on every pick, but they got their stars through the draft. I think another thing that worked is, and I think what separated them from some other ongoing rebuilds, Orlando, I think, is the one that people draw the most contrast between. They didn't dick around with, like, we're going to sign Ben Gordon to a 4-year, $32 million deal. Like, we're not going to waste a roster spot on a veteran who's going to help us a little bit in the short term and have no bearing on our long-term outcome. They were like, we're just going to get a ton of salary dumps so we can get more picks. We're going to take a bunch of flyers on these 10-day guys and undrafted free agents. And if a couple of them hit, they're worth their weight in gold. And they got Robert Covington and TJ McConnell, both of whom turned into legitimate rotation players, and Robert Covington, who they ended up flipping as the centerpiece of a Jimmy Butler trade a couple years later.
Yeah.
So I think those are all things that worked from the Sixers' perspective. But TJ, I'm curious, as an outsider, like, what did you see, you know, while watching the Sixers rebuild, and especially comparing it to the Nuggets? Like, what did and didn't work for you?
What's most interesting to me is just the decisions that were made and then just proceeded to not actually work out. Whether it was the Nuggets trying to trade their young players, even though they kept preaching, do not skip steps, we're going to build our young core in-house. Despite that, they wanted Kevin Love during the Paul George and LeBron team-up times during that draft. They made a big play to get Jimmy Butler, but instead of him going to Philly, I believe is what it was, actually. They also poked around quite a bit on Zach LaVine a couple times throughout the process of, you know, the past 5 years. I believe it's like two or three times in different seasons that they've poked around for Zach LaVine. So there were moments in which all of this becomes the same situation that Philly was in, which I find absolutely fascinating because it literally comes down to one or two decisions. So when I look back at the Philly side, trading Wilson Chandler, Mike Muscala, and Landry Shamet for Tobias Harris, Boban, and Mike Scott, that's the deal. That was when they decided that we are transitioning from rebuilding to using all of the assets that we have to try and make a big play. That singular decision shifted their entire path towards contention. And once they did that, they were stuck. And that was, you know, the Elton Brand started all of this. And when that happened, you realize that everything that you had worked for, what, 7 years, 6 years to get to that point, it had all been balled up and tossed in the garbage can while saying Kobe. Like, it was over. And there was nothing else you were going to do at that point. And that's the one trade. The Nuggets did not make a trade like that. And that, I think, is the only differentiation that you can make. Because, like, again, they traded Jeremy Grant for a first-round pick and Ersan Ilyasova. When I think about a perfect power forward to put next to Joel Embiid, Jeremy Grant's the guy. But retrospect is 2020. A first and Ersan, who again is the kind of player you want to fit with them, it makes sense. And the Nuggets have similar trades like that as well. I don't have any issue with the Butler trade. You always trade for a super, super, superstar whenever you can. That makes sense to me. But trading Fultz at the time felt very bizarre. I get that they had ruined the circumstances circumstance and it wasn't really redeemable at that point, but the fact that the organizational structure allowed it to get to that point is more concerning than the actual outcome that led to it. So for me, going back to my very, very, very first point on this show, the Nuggets didn't just rebuild their roster. They rebuilt how ownership works with the new front office, with the new coaching staff that has been built out and by the people who were going to be leading their respective departments. They placed trust in individuals and allowed them to do that. I do not believe the Colangelos have very much trust in anybody who is not named Colangelo. And I honestly think that's the biggest difference. There is not, there may be a lot of cooks in the kitchen for Denver per se, because it was Calvin Booth, Arturis, Tim Connolly, Michael Malone, Josh Kroenke all in the room making these decisions, but they made them together and they worked through it. And there was an actual thought process behind it. It wasn't, let's see what Elton Brand can do. Oh, you want to trade for a star? Good luck. We'll see how that works out. Like that doesn't exist within Denver. There is a true community of people who are making decisions together with only the best interest of the team in mind. And I think that is really the biggest difference in why a trade like that didn't happen in Denver compared to it happening in Philly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we were talking earlier about like ownership's willingness to spend. And that is unquestionably a huge asset in a real rebuilding process. But, you know, as I alluded to with Mort's long-term plan earlier, Hinkie was appealing because he had a long-term plan. And then the Sixers owners kneecapped him about 6 months before that plan really started to come to fruition. And now we've had three regime changes, effectively Hinkie to the Colangelos and now to Brand, where the continuity of, you know, when Sam came into power, Julius Irving gave an interview, I think in like 2014, he's like, this is a 5 to 7 year thing. By the end of it, we're going to be back in a contention. And if you look, it was like by year 5 to 7, they were right back, you know, in the second round of the playoffs every year, winning 50 plus games. Like, it went according to timeline. There were some hiccups in there, of course.
There always will be.
You're right.
The Nuggets traded Eric Green for Rudy Gobert on draft night. Like, there's always going to be these things.
Right. You're not going to hit every single move. But I think the lack of continuity in the Sixers front office is ultimately what set them down the path that they went on. Where it's, okay, we just feel this constant pressure, which is weird because the fans were on board. Like, they were
that's
strangely on board.
It drives me crazy that they panicked for no reason, for no public outcry. There was no PR disaster, none of it. They just folded.
Right.
I don't get that. It's like having a 16 in blackjack and being like, I don't know whether to hit or stay. So, you know what? Screw it. I'm folding. I'm out. I don't know what to do. And it doesn't. Right. It just doesn't make sense to me. And I also think I there was a piece on the rights to Ricky Sanchez that was written by Sixers Adam way back in the day where he kind of just roasted the organization. He was like, listen, there are some very real issues and it needs to be understood how this works. The egos that are involved in Philadelphia compared to the complete lack of egos that exist in Denver is also a massive part of this. Someone wants their name to be the reason why things worked in Philly. In Denver, they could not care less. It's a Queensbred New Yorker in Michael Malone who just wants to win playing defense. And it's just like deeply ingrained in him. It's Tim Connolly, who if it was his choice, he'd be scouting, not running a damn team. Like, if it wasn't for the money boost, I bet you he wants no part in trying to figure out who their hygiene officer is going to be. Like, that's not what he wants to do. So, like, there's no ego. Arturis Karnisovas is a robot. The dude is stoic. You will never feel like he is coming after you aggressively or is trying to undermine you. None of that exists. There is no mutiny that can potentially exist. There's not this complete lack of understanding of how the people around you operate. There was just that alignment. That's the word that the Nuggets continually keep using, and I think it's the important one, because when you don't have an ego and you're just in line and you're doing the best that you can do, it's going to be so much easier than whatever the hell is going on in Philly right now.
Yeah, I think there needs to be.
Is alignment just another term for synergy, but they just want to get away from the corporate buzzword?
Yes, it's the non-Silicon Valley version of synergy, for sure.
Perfect.
But it's like you need alignment or synergy or whatever you want to call it from the ownership, because if the ownership's not on board or if they change paths halfway through like the Sixers owners did, you're screwed. Mm-hmm. But from ownership through the coaching staff, through front office, like all the way down to the players. Like, everyone needs to be aligned on here's what we're doing, here's why we're doing it the way we're doing it. And if you have that, then you have the ingredients for a successful rebuild. But if you don't, or if you change paths in the middle, all of a sudden it's, you know, your coach or your front office is thinking one thing, or like, I mean, Chicago is a perfect example, right? Where your coach is doing one thing, the front office is possibly thinking another thing, and the ownership is maybe even thinking another thing, mm-hmm. where it's like, well, what's the actual plan here? Like, what is the long-term vision that we are embracing? Or do we even have a long-term vision? And if you don't, you're going to be stuck in purgatory.
And people don't really... Well, sorry, Mark, go ahead.
To be fair, with the Sixers, though, like, and you brought it up, CJ, in terms of like the Tobias Harris trade, that's when everything kind of switched. That's when they went from a rebuild into actually trying to contend. Let's just play that out before that happens, right? Because the Markelle Fultz thing, to me, that's where everything started happening. Because if Markelle Fultz is his old ass self from Washington, mm-hmm. if he comes in and he doesn't have that busted shoulder and whatever happened, that this whole timeline changed. This is like a community alternate timeline and situation ultimately.
Yeah.
Because I don't think they would have gone for Tobias Harris, which would have led to Jimmy Butler, which would have led to all sorts of craziness in terms of the trade market. I don't think those moves would have been made. I think they would have stayed the course. And I think, ironically, they would have been looked at as very closely like Denver in terms of having kept a lot of the young guys moving. Because, again, Markelle Fultz, full steam ahead, no injury concern. Come on, he would be like a 20.2 score right now. And like the way he shot the ball at Washington, God, he would be
game was so
like,
good.
He was outstanding. Like that three ball. I mean, look, you know, the shoulder is one thing, and I get that he wasn't a good three throw shooter in college as well. And some people were like, well,
"Yeah,
is that 3-point shot legit?" Yes, it was. It was absolutely legit. Don't overthink it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's when everything kind of changed, because now you're out an asset, a major asset, because you lost both trades ultimately solely because of that damn shoulder. Now you have to pivot, right? You have to do something, because otherwise you're just going to waste Embiid. You're going to waste Ben Simmons, and this is when the Sixers just didn't have a backup plan. They just kind of said, "Uh-oh, we need to do something, so we're pivoting." And I think, like you guys said, stuff just comes up sometimes. You have to adjust. You have to pivot. You have to do something else. Like, so my question here is, what should Philly have done instead of pivoting towards being win now?
My thing with that is they gave him the worst possible circumstance to grow, and all of these eyes on him at all. Do you remember all the videos that would come out of that practice facility? They ruined his mental confidence. They completely obliterated it. So yes, I agree with you. That is probably the deal that completely shifted the way that they went about things, but it was entirely self-inflicted, and that's the part to me that I don't want to use it as the catalyst, because there was no reason for that to exist in that capacity. He could have gotten that injury, and none of this should have existed in that way. That is 100% self-inflicted. It's something that the 76ers should have owned up to instead of letting some poor 19-year-old kid get eviscerated by people, and they never actually did it. So the point that it was irredeemable and the trade had to be happened because there was nowhere else to go was because they burnt every bridge around them and were stuck on an island and couldn't go anywhere, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think if we're, you know, going big picture, 30,000 foot view here for other teams as well, it speaks to, you know, you have Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons. You have the two superstars that most other teams would kill for right now, but your work isn't done there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, getting the superstars is step one. Building a roster around them is step two. And you know, that on paper, the Fultz trade made sense. Like, he is on paper, pre-draft Markelle Fultz is the perfect prospect to pair with Simmons and Embiid. It didn't pan out for obvious reasons. And yeah, it seemed like the Sixers just did not have more. As you said, they didn't have a backup plan. They like got so excited by that playoff run, that first playoff run where they win 16 games straight at the end of the season, and then they beat Miami in the first round, and they lose to Boston. It just seems like that accelerated their timeline, where they think like, oh, we're ready to win right now. It's like, no, Joel Embiid is 25 and is turnover prone and is out of shape every year. And Ben Simmons still won't shoot threes and cramps the spacing of the entire team. Like, these guys weren't ready to be the number one option on the title team yet, but they they acted like they were.
I have a hot take. It's not about finding multiple stars in the draft. It's about finding one and building around the one and then finding the right star to pair with them. Just getting two stars is not the way to being able to rebuild your franchise into contention. When you start with two stars like this, you don't know where these gaps are going to be. You don't know how these players are going to develop. You don't know what parts of the game that you're going to have to fix. Even with Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid and JJ Redick, one of the most lights out lethal all-time shooters that plays specifically off ball, there still wasn't enough spacing. Robert Covington can shoot 40% from three, still wasn't enough spacing. The Nuggets had the benefit of just getting Nikola, building around Nikola, learning Nikola. What is he like? What makes him at his best? And then finding ways to fill in after that. If you just get two stars, I don't think that that does as much for you as it looks like on paper.
Well, it depends on who they are. Like, you can't get lucky, and those
but it's luck,
two
and
just,
that's kind of my point. Yeah, that's kind of my point.
Well, I agree with that, but at the same time, and I think this needs to be said when we're talking about rebuilding processes, you need luck to rebuild properly as well. You need a lot of luck. Yeah. I mean, so my personal way of if I was sitting there interviewing for a GM job and how I would rebuild, I would actually have like a 3-year window where I could just go all in on the draft, where I would want to optimize the amount of draft picks I had at my disposal for a 3-year period. But look, I could go 0-4-9 if I have 9 draft picks, I could miss on all of them at some level, and at some point you just need to have luck on your side. So so that's an important ingredient in this as well.
So how much is luck? I'm so curious the degree of it, because in my eyes, the league has shifted to a hyper more intelligent decision makers in front offices in the past 10 years. So yes, luck was way more important 10 years ago than it is right now. I think now you're seeing teams like, you know, or front office members, whether it's Masai Ujiri, who's been doing this forever as a drafter, Tim Connelly, Sam Presti. These are people who just do their work. And when there are enough smart individuals in front offices, I think the luck ratio goes down quite a bit, which is why I started out by saying you have to get a guy who knows how to go about the draft and how to find the right types of players in the draft, which is what the Nuggets did bringing in a guy like Tim Connelly, which is also what the Bulls are doing by bringing in Arturas Karnašovas. So I do wonder if that luck has been minimized. I think your point is incredibly important, and I think it's absolutely fair and it should be involved in this, but I do wonder if that amount of luck has shifted in the past decade.
It has. It absolutely has, because back in the day, when you sit there and you read books from the 80s and the 90s about like the draft selection process, it's like, you know, I get visions of going back to the Stone Age. You're sitting there with a small rock.
Jerry Krause's, your head doesn't count for how tall you are. Did you see that? They don't count your head inches because it's not usable inches in basketball.
So now you're barking up the wrong tree, because I've made that point with Donovan Mitchell before.
Interesting. What, he's like 5 foot eight without a head? Is that that's the point?
No. Basically, when you have a short neck, like if your shoulder height can be really important. I think if you have, like, you remember Martinez Andruskevicius back in the day, the former Bulls center, like 7'4" or something. His neck, like, made him 7'4".
He looked like a giraffe.
Correct. He did. If you took his shoulder height, he would probably be closer to 6'10". And he played small. That was a part of it. And then you had Donovan Mitchell, who has this very, very small neck. And his shoulder height is probably equal to someone 6'4" instead of someone 6'1". So I think shoulder height does matter to an extent. Because you know what I carry as the most importance here? Is that's what's inside one's head, though.
I just find it funny that Morton is that Mort is out here right now defending Jerry Krause on a podcast. I'm just like, think about as you're saying these things.
Look, I'll give Jerry this. He won 6 rings.
Yes, he did. Yeah. And his decisions were a monstrous part of being able to keep that dynasty going.
Exactly. So that is something. But I'm just saying that you had the most weirdest stories. Yeah. You had with, you know, some guy who saw some kid in a gym, and then you called up your buddy, the GM, who you just happened to find somehow, and you go, "All right, I saw a kid." Yeah. Oh, okay, cool. We'll draft him. What? Like, I totally agree. Today, it's like nothing is left up to just coincidence or randomness. Like, everything is being just scoured through. Hey, we're considering drafting someone in the late 50s. Cool, ring his third grade teacher so I can answer that, right? Everything is like there now. So I agree with you.
With that being said, Phil Jackson made Dennis Smith Jr. eat octopus for the first time as part of their interview process. So there are still some archaic idiots that exist in the NBA world.
Oh, but you know, what would the NBA be without that? It's charming. It's romantic. Octopus. We need more octopus stories.
Octopus and soup stories. Give me all of them.
Yeah. But I think ultimately, I agree with you. Today, you can make educated decisions in a far wider scope than you could just 10 years ago. I think it boils down to a combination of what we've been talking about for the past 50 minutes. It's you need the I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to say synergy. What was it?
Alignment? Alignment, yes.
All right. So you need the alignment. You need an owner who's willing to spend. Then you need all these top professional front office guys who isn't in it to get headlines, as you talked about, who's in it for the work. Then you need to be 5% lucky if outside of what you do in draft preparations. You also need to have a long-term plan. All of these things have to go hand in hand, and you cannot skip steps.
That's the big one.
Any of these things. Yeah.
So let's go into just some of the other teams around the league that have been mired in the either perpetual mediocrity or worse for the last couple of years and figure out, quick hit.
Oh, I know where you're going.
Yeah. What went wrong here? So the New York Knicks are the punchline of the NBA forever, right?
Yes.
But what are they doing wrong? Why can't they figure this thing out?
Well, that's easy. Come on. When you have an owner who gives potential free agents his own CD, that's game over.
And if you make every player who comes through your organization hate you, you're not going to have a good opportunity to keep people coming to your organization. I don't know. That's the most simplistic thing about the Knicks. They make everybody who goes there hate the Knicks somehow. And I'm just, that's as simple as it gets for me.
No, yeah. I think I know why. I think when James Dolan, he's the type of guy who doesn't really look at players as individuals or as human beings.
Assets,
he looks at them as, pardon?
Assets. They're just assets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and not in the good way when we talk about assets. He looks at them as faceless jocks, right, in some capacity. So you also need the personal aspect. If you're an NBA organization who do this the right way, you need to have a front-facing mentality, even if you're a GM. We've all heard this idea beforehand that some GMs are kind of we're letting, I don't talk to my players because, it'll be hard if I have to trade them one day. No, don't. Talk to your players. Yes. That builds a relationship. It helps. It makes that player feel, valued. It makes them feel that they have a role moving forward. That is crucial. And these relationships and the way that you communicate as an organization from top to bottom, that's just such a huge element. And for the Knicks, they have none of that.
Yeah.
The internal communication, as we've seen reported multiple times over the past few years, is non-existent. So that's, to me, is the one part of it. And then, of course, the overall incompetence.
Just the Knicks of the Knicks. Yep.
Exactly. Just, I think, someone like Orlando is a much funner team to bring up because, they have legit issues. It's not just one owner who's completely insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's go into Orlando because, they made the playoffs last year. They're 42-40, but they've, missed the playoffs in each of the past six seasons. They are, when the season suspended, they were the eighth seed, but they're 30-35. They haven't had a record above 500 since, or significantly above 500, I should say, since Dwight Howard was there. So, they trade Dwight Howard in 2012, and obviously they start a rebuild from there. But why haven't they dug out? I mean, it's been 8 years, basically. Why are they still stuck in, we are lucky if we are the 7 or 8 seed?
And before TJ answers, because this one goes to TJ, let's just remind our listeners of one thing. After that Dwight Howard trade, they looked really good.
Yeah.
Holy. Yeah. We're looking at that as Orlando is the winner here. They could be the winner because they look really good. They have everything moving for them right now, or just everything at their disposal. So they were coming up Milhouse, and then things went wrong.
And they've kind of just continued on that path. It seems like they've made correct decisions that haven't panned out. Jonathan Isaac is a hell of a player, and I don't think people realize that. Mo Bamba is always this that's always going to be a questionable pick in my eyes, but they've made risks, they've taken risks, and they've gone out of their path, and they've tried to build a functional team. My thing is that they have never once found a consistency in how they play basketball to build a roster for their scheme. That has never existed. They have four power forwards and they want to play a drive and kick game, or it's always something that doesn't work schematically when I watch them. And you know, you see the drafting of Mo Bamba. They're going to spread the floor more, which gives Jonathan Isaac more room to play power forward and be a mismatch and all these beautiful things. But there are so many small little issues that just haven't worked out, that haven't allowed us to see what they can do. So I'm actually not out on the Magic yet. I think they have done 75% of the job, and I think there's a reality in which some of these players start to click and they start to connect and they find the role players who've meshed this team together well to where they can finally start getting more out of it.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the Magic, it just seems like they've been trying to take the shortcuts. And I think the same applies for the Knicks, where they just haven't had the patience to say, we're going to suck for a couple years, and then, but we're going to like put the things in place that we need, so when we have the right players, we're going to get good. I think the Magic are also somewhat unlucky, at least in terms of, you know, their 1 year that they had a top three pick. They got Oladipo at two, which is great, but he didn't really take off until after he left the team. And then, you know, they flip Oladipo and Sabonis for a half-season rental of Serge Ibaka.
That's brutal. That's,
right, like, that is the original sin of, like, here's why you are stuck so far, you know, down in this rebuilding process. Like, why you haven't taken steps forward is because, like, there was no reason to trade for Serge Ibaka then.
Or to give Terrence Ross that contract that was, like, 3 years of $75 million or whatever it was.
Right, exactly. And, like, now they just have such a front court logjam where, you know, it makes sense. Of course, you don't want to lose Nikola Vucevic for nothing. He's your all-star center. But you have Aaron Gordon, Jonathan Isaac, Mo Bamba. You just brought in Al-Farouq Aminu this year. You now have Chuma Okeke, too. Like, you have so many guys who play the same two or three positions. Like, Aaron Gordon has played 40% of his minutes this year at the three.
It drives me, like, mental. He played shooting guard this year at points. I was like, what are we? Oh, God. Again, right. Schematically. So, like,
I mean, if there is a hashtag free Aaron Gordon campaign, you're not, something's gone wrong here.
Well, see, you just brought up, like, the trades and stuff, right?
Yeah.
It goes deeper than that, because then you have Mario Hezonja, who's the fifth overall pick in 2015, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you let him, you didn't even pick up his fourth year option.
Yep.
And then he went to the Knicks. Essentially, you just wasted a top five draft pick.
Yeah.
That is huge currency. That's like if you walked in New York and you had like $2,000 in your wallet in cash and you just dropped it. You can look back afterwards, 2 seconds later, that's gone. You're never seeing those $2,000 again.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. They just waste so many draft picks indirectly, because then you had the Elfrid Payton trade. You ended up, you know, actually attaching a pick in that trade to get Elfrid Payton on draft night. Yep. And then you ended up trading him for a second rounder, I want to say.
Yeah, it was Phoenix. A second rounder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, again, that's just a waste.
It's bad asset management, for sure. They've always done that.
It is. Like, right before when we talked about the Knicks, we mentioned the word assets. And obviously players shouldn't just be viewed as assets, but you have to look at the value in these players, and you have to understand, in order to improve, if there are guys that we don't want to have around, we have to trade them at a right point, or we have to put them in a situation where we can at least get their trade value up. They've just kind of they've been reacting instead of just being progressive and acting and doing something like, on their own accord. They've just been reacting all the time, and you don't get anywhere.
So how do we judge the risks that teams are taking? Because I think that's an integral part to being able to rebuild, are taking these risks that we are talking about. And while they will burn you to a crisp, they are also the reason that people are hailed as geniuses. So at what level are these risks also required of the Magic to continue taking them? Guys like Mo Bamba, like, that's an important kind of decision, because if it does work, it changes your entire franchise.
Right. See, so the thing with me here is, I think even though you can theoretically be a game-changing center, I think the center position has been so devalued lately that you can find someone who might be 60% of what an optimal Mo Bamba could be.
Yeah.
for like 5 to 7 million on the market.
Well, yeah, like how much big is Brook Lopez? Like he's like twice the player that Mo Bamba is, and the actual amount of, you know, commitment that you have to make is so much lesser.
Yeah. So for me, it's all about what's the alternative? Like what's there that you could have done otherwise? Like I agree with you. At some point, you need to go for the home run. But what you have to identify what that home run is. Is it a swat? Is it a shot blocking center? I don't think it is.
Yeah,
I think it's that ball handling wing at 6'9" who can get into the paint at will and who can find shooters like at full speed.
Yeah.
So you also have to be like you have to be good at understanding who's the guy that I want to cash in my chips on. Who's that dude? And is Mo Bamba ever going to be that dude?
I don't think so.
Fail to see. Yeah. No, right? And so I think, again, it comes down to just an understanding of where the NBA is.
Well, and, you know, Mort, you're bringing up, like, wasting assets and wasting draft picks. And another team that jumps to mind right away is Phoenix.
Yeah.
Because if you look, I mean, they've done somewhat well, at least in terms of finding value later in drafts. But, like... Yeah. You know, they found TJ Warren at 14 overall in 2014. 5 years later, they pay a pick to get off of his contract.
Yeah.
His contract is reasonable. And then he turns
out... And he's good.
Yeah, right. Like, that is just a complete waste of... Like, what... you should be getting something for TJ Warren. TJ Warren is not a salary dump.
TJ Warren is worth a first-round pick to a lot of teams right now.
Right. So, like, giving up at number 32 was just a complete waste. I mean, Devin Booker, they nail at number 13 in 2015. Dragan Bender was a miss in 2016. And then they trade, I think it was 8, 13, and 28 to get up to Marquise Chris as well. That was, you know, that bust. Like, they have had a number of whiffs at the top. Josh Jackson, number 4 in 2017 as well. So, you know, they have Booker, they have Ayton. But it strikes me as like a lack of patience, like trading Zaire Smith and a completely unprotected pick from Miami for Mikal Bridges, who is a great player. Mm-hmm. Like, I would have loved to see him on the Sixers. I think he would have provided a lot of what they're missing right now. But he's the type of player that you add when you're like a 45-win team, and he could be that like glue guy missing piece. Like, he's not worth giving up a first-round pick. He's not going to change the trajectory of your franchise. So,
right, and this is the issue, right? Because if you let's just route up the TJ Warren thing.
Yeah.
Suns fans were arguing that the reason that they traded Warren was to clear up minutes for everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
That's what every losing team argues.
Exactly. Right. But here's the problem with that is, you know, if whatever the reason is you trade him, fine. But that doesn't mean you have to go on a compromise for his trade value.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that you have to get desperate and send him out and basically pay to get him out of town just to clear up minutes. No, you play coy. You tell teams, we really like this guy. He is good. He's averaging 20 points a game. He's starting to shoot threes really well even. He hit 43% from downtown. You for you to get him, you need to pay up. Like, you can't call someone and say, well, gosh, we really need to get off of this contract. Well, you don't say.
Yeah.
That's just killing yourself, right? I mean, so for the Suns specifically, I just want to get ahead of that because you know we're going to get Suns fans in our comments about this, and I think it's crucial for them to understand it's not about their plan of clearing minutes.
Right.
It's about understanding what value is.
And another part of this, like the alignment that we've talked about so much, they've had like 17 head coaches. How is anybody going to develop when you don't even know who you're going to play for every 4 months? So that alone is just, it's impossible to have a true player development staff when it changes over and over and over again. It's like taking the same class with 7 different teachers. You're going to get so much of the same information, or the terminology is different, so you get confused, and suddenly you don't know what is right. And it leaves you lost. And that's when I look at guys like Marquise Chris, guys like Dragan Bender, guys like even DeAndre Ayton, who just are so clearly without knowing where to be on a basketball court. And I think that is 100% because of their lack of consistency with any part of their coaching staff. They have never had that. And now, you know, Monty Williams is doing a much better job. And you saw like real growth with that team this year. And they got an actual point guard in Ricky Rubio. And the culture is better. And like, all of those things are really important. They've never had any of those things. And that, I think, is the crux of the issue with that Phoenix Suns team. And also, they got lucky with... Let's not pretend that they didn't get lucky with Booker. Like, that's not just, they got lucky on that pick as well. And Sarver is miserable, so doesn't help that you have bad ownership on top of all of this.
Yeah, but, you know, as Mort said, like, you do need to get lucky sometimes. The Milwaukee Bucks are not where they are if Giannis Antetokounmpo does not fall to 15 and turn into an MVP candidate. Yes. Like, it requires... I mean, same with the Raptors and Pascal Siakam. Yep. Like, these things, you know, Rudy Gobert and the Jazz. Gobert. Yeah. So it requires luck if you're going to find... I mean, hell, even the Warriors with Draymond Green. Yep. Like, you're not expected to get a defensive player of the year with the number 35 overall pick. You're not expected to get Steph Curry at 7, who's going to turn into the greatest shooter of all time, or Klay Thompson at 11, who's going to be the second greatest shooter of all time. Like, it takes luck, for sure. I mean, if we're going to, like, say, what is the key to a rebuild, luck is definitely high on that list.
For sure.
The key to a rebuild is also having a cap explosion in 2016.
And Steph Curry having broken ankles for the first three years of his career.
Yeah. I mean...
Yeah.
The ability for that Warriors team to exist is just so bizarre. It took so many planets aligning for that to work out, man. I hope people remember that. I really hope that they don't, like, man, the NBA is the worst in 10 years. Like, I really hope they remember why that happened.
Well, the worst thing is it just screwed up how every other team had to team build for the next couple of years, because it was like, oh, well, they have four superstars, so we need four superstars. It's like, no, this was a one-time fluke. This is never happening again.
And
it's
Draymond as the superstar is already so much a farce in that regard anyway. Right. Like, yeah, sure, a guy who shoots four times a game as a superstar is not exactly the same thing as having four stars on your team.
Right. So... I mean, ultimately, we've gone through a number of teams, and I think, you know, it's instructive to look at, like, the Knicks and the Magic and the Suns, because there are teams like Atlanta and like Memphis now. New Orleans is an outlier, I think, just because, you know, you trade Anthony Davis, you get so much back that that's going to kickstart your rebuild. But, like, Atlanta has done a really good job just in 2 years or so, and the Nets even a couple years, you know, before getting in KD and Kyrie, like... This thing doesn't have to take 10-plus years. Like, some teams can do it quickly. Memphis is on that trajectory, too, where, yeah, they got lucky to jump up to number two to get John Morant. But, you know, Jaren Jackson Jr. falls to them at four, and they're like, all right, we're going to get the second-best player of this draft at number four. That's great.
Yeah.
This worked out really
imagine how good Boston would be if they wanted to trade Terry Rozier back in the day.
I still can't believe that was a thing. They were like, no, you know what we got to hold on to? Terry Rozier. Never get past that. Terry Rozier, fantasy killer and miserable NBA player.
Yeah, yeah. The double whammy, as it were.
I'm just realizing something. Because my former team, the Bulls, hired... Well, one of each from your
Mark
teams.
Mark Eversley and Arturas Karnstrom.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Although, to be fair, there are more Nuggets over there than there are Philly guys. Pat Connolly at least with them.
Probably for the best. But let's now that we've talked through all these teams, let's like kind of go through quickly, like, what are the big takeaways? What should teams do and what shouldn't teams do when you're starting to rebuild, other than if you're the Pelicans, trade Anthony Davis for everything and, you know, be really lucky in that regard. Like, if you are starting,
you should get
scratch,
a superstar.
Yeah.
So the two things for me is scout as well as you can. You bring somebody in who can build your team through the draft, and then you find a coach who can incorporate the culture that you want to exist from day one. You need to start from day one, and if you allow different regimes to be involved, like Philly has done, where they've taken out pieces and replaced people but haven't actually rebuilt the front office, it'll always have pieces from prior regimes, and you need to start fresh, and you need to give a coach the ability to actually build the culture that you want to exist.
And vice versa. 100%. For example, if we use the Bulls as an example, because they're going to go into a different rebuild, I have to assume, then you cannot hang on to Jim Boylan. And not for the reasons that are obvious, that he's horrible, more so because he was a PAX guy. You can't do that. You need a fresh slate. I mean, Karnišovas and Eberle need to be able to hire someone else. And, you know, fingers crossed, it's Adrian Griffin. I think that would be a tremendous hire. You're laughing.
Just don't forget the name Chris Finch. I know it's a quiet one. This is not reporting. Yep. This is all speculation. Chris Finch unlocked Nikola Jokic offensively. He's also the one that made Boogie and Anthony Davis work together in New Orleans. Him as an offensive mind is spectacular. He has an existing relationship with Arturas. And when you have Lauri Markkanen and Wendell Carter in a front court, that's the guy I'm calling.
Interesting. See, I've noticed that you've been bringing up on Twitter over the yes. past few years here and there. So I'm glad you brought him up because I to be honest, I forgot. You're absolutely right. That's a good name. I think Adrian Griffin just seems to be in that
he's in that conversation NBA now. Guy, yeah. See,
yeah, and he's been working the sidelines, you know, as an assistant for so long. It seems like now is his time, sort of. As well, and then, like, he's in high regard and he's a player's coach, which, hell, this is going to be the first time in a while that the Bulls will have a player's
coach. Wes Unseld Jr. Is another name when we're talking about player's coaches who could potentially be in the mix for Chicago. Wes Unseld Jr. is the Nuggets lead assistant coach right now. I have not met somebody who is beloved by every single player in the way that he is. From Vlatko Chanchar, first time here after being in Real Madrid, and he's I believe he's Slovenian, and then all the way up to Will Barton, inner city Baltimore bred and raised, you know, crazy amazing dude, but there's so few people like that who can do that. So I would definitely keep Wes Unseld Jr. Yeah. as a name on your mind as well.
Right. And like just basically a new coach. So you can start over with an entirely new regime. And then the question to me is, because you brought it up, TJ, regarding like the whole change up, like you need to go about it thoroughly. What about the roster? Like, do you hang on to certain players because you see the potential there? Or do you also say right from the get-go, screw it, gone with everyone because there is an established superstar, start over from
absolutely
scratch.
Not start over from scratch with the roster. I would be surprised if there's going to be changeover, but to restart, no. He's going to love Wendell Carter because he already does. I talked about Wendell Carter like randomly with him during the draft. The Nuggets liked Wendell better than Marvin Bagley. They are very, very high on Wendell Carter. Lauri Markkanen is the exact kind of power forward, sharpshooter, shot blocker, potentially has mobility at some point in his career that fits with Wendell Carter. When I look at that front court, I think Arturis Karnišovas is very excited about the potential that those two represent. But then, Kobe White, Zach LaVine, Chris Dunn, those players I have a much more difficult time trying to quantify Arturis kind of exists. I think that Kobe White will get his run. He's just too talented. He just genuinely is. Like, that second half of the season, when he wasn't just shooting like 75% from three, but creating for everybody, getting downhill, showing off the flashiness, that was when you're like, all right, there is a real potential for a J.R. Smith-esque kind of bench volume microwave score. But I don't know about Zach LaVine, because Zach LaVine and Jamal Murray carry so many similarities in how they play. There are ways you would like them to play, and there is the way that they actually play. And that is just kind of...
And then there's the contract.
Yes, and there's the contract. So I do wonder, I'm sure he'll look out there in the market. Arturis is not nervous. Arturis is going to call everybody he feels like calling about, whatever player he feels like calling about. He has some messiahness to him in that way where he's kind of cutthroat if he needs to be. And you wouldn't know it because he's so stoic and just easily approachable. But I do think Wendell, Lauri will stay. I do wonder, I think Chris Dunn's gone. I don't think it makes sense to have Chris Dunn. You need a better creator at that point guard position. And I also think that you're going to see them really look at what you can get for Zach LaVine, either around the draft, if they want to get a player, or around the trade deadline when they start trying to open up more flexibility going forward.
And this, just to on the record, it's not just the Bulls we're talking about, but it just makes sense to bring them up because they had this regime change. Because when we talk about a rebuild can be many things. Like, you can have the same regime start a rebuild on their own terms and just basically just restart the roster, essentially. Yeah. That counts for a rebuild. But this is an organizational rebuild. This is top to bottom. Everything goes to start over, which I think is fascinating because now you can actually see all these things that we're talking about trying to be implemented about, you know, alignment, making sure that people in different departments are on the same page, an increased scouting staff.
That, like, the Bulls, that's a huge one. And also the player development staff. I saw a report today. They had one player development coach last year. This is the National Basketball Association. How do you have one player? The Nuggets have six, and they have a small staff. So they, again, you want to talk about rebuilding the Bulls. You got, screw trying to figure out all the other stuff. Get a staff together. Like, just let's at least, create an ability to actually have something substantial. Because when you have one player development coach and you're not even scouting Europe, you're not going to do anything in this iteration of NBA basketball. Not a damn thing.
Right.
And I think while we're specifically focusing on the Bulls right now, that these points apply to any team in the start of a rebuild. You have to evaluate top to bottom your roster and say, do these guys fit the vision that we are trying to play moving forward? The on-court vision, the locker room, like, do we trust these guys not to be idiots off the court? If not, we need to move them and get value while we can and really, like, start to move into the direction, the overall direction that we want. And regardless right. of, as you said, Moritz, like, not every team is going to fire the coach, fire the general manager, whatever, when they start a rebuild. They might have the same guys in place, and they're just going to say, all right, this group ran its course. You know, we saw this with the Clippers in the last couple of years, where it was like, all right, the Blake CP3 DeAndre thing, it just didn't work for whatever reason, and we got to break this thing up, and now look at where they are, you know, in a couple of years from where they started taking the sledgehammer to them. So I think, TJ, you know, you were saying scouting 100%. Like, scouting in the draft needs to be, every team needs to be focused on that, regardless of whether you're rebuilding. Like, just every single, all 30 teams should be
Everyone.
Focused on it.
The Warriors could have used a better draft instead of Jordan Bell. Just imagine if they got a cheap player that was a wing who could actually help them. Like, those are really important things for contending teams.
Yeah. And then we mentioned ownership. I really do think both the willingness to pay the tax is crucial, but also having a long-term plan, hiring the right guys, delegating responsibilities to them, not intervening, because I think that's another place where the Knicks fall short. Mm-hmm. You know, you just hear about, like, Shadow Dolan, like, hanging over all these decisions. You just have to, like, empower you hire these guys and empower them. Empower them and trust them to make these decisions. They'll bring them to you. They're going to have to convince you to sign off on them. But, you know, don't get involved. Don't meddle. The more you meddle, you don't know more than these basketball lifers.
Yeah, trust basketball people to make basketball decisions. Like, it seems so simple, but so few owners are willing to do it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, don't get too loyal, because Garpak should not have gotten a 17-year tenure.
Right.
But there's levels to this, too. Like, there's also, like, you know, 3 years is way too short, but, like, no one should be given a 17-year runway to be functional. Like, that's just still so beyond my understanding with that organization.
Right.
Yeah.
No, but you make a good point. Like, you shouldn't panic after 3 years. Like, if you give them 7 or 8 years and things just look just as bleak as when you started, like, fair enough. Like, you can make a change. I think that's reasonable. That's almost a decade to prove something. Like, you can look at that and go, well, I have enough data. Something we haven't discussed yet, which I think is really important, and that ties a little bit into the Sixers and Sam Hinkie, like the Sam Hinkie special, and in terms of just using money wisely.
Yeah.
Because one thing is, like, even if you get a couple superstars in there, and even if you build around one guy, like you alluded to, TJ, but if you have, like, the top core in place and you need to add pieces from the outside before those contracts need to be extended, make sure you spend it on the right guy. Make sure you don't go out, if you have cap space and you're a team and you sign, oh, I don't know, Al Horford to a team that has Joel Embiid at center. That would be, like, that's just an example.
And don't spend money to spend money. There was no reason to trade for Tobias Harris. Not a single need reason. It was not necessary. Yeah. Like, the idea that you guys go get Jay Crowder for, like, 80% less and he'll do 70% of the job, like, it's incredibly terrible financial investments. It really is.
Yeah.
And I think spending money wisely ties into what we were talking about with the Nuggets earlier, where these financial windows are not forever. Like, teams have to nail these decisions. You get your stars in place, great. You continue to draft well, great. If you continue to draft well, the players that you have after they come off their rookie contracts are all going to get significant raises, and you're going to have to start making tough decisions about who to keep, who to trade, who to just let walk as free agents. Like, you don't have, I mean, the NBA salary cap and luxury tax, it's a very effective system. It was well designed, and it, you know, outside of 2016, where we had the one-time unprecedented spike, like, it forces teams to either just spend out the ass in luxury tax, which most teams are not willing to do, or they're going to have to let good players go and get rid of them.
The best example of this, and Mort kind of pointed it out, the Nuggets made 3 draft picks when they drafted Jamal Murray. It was Jamal Murray, Malik Beasley, Juancho Hernangómez. The biggest reason Malik Beasley and Juancho are not in Denver were that they were drafted the same year as Jamal. That is the only reason that they're not in Denver right now. If it was any other circumstance, they would probably still be in Denver. And they didn't plan on taking 3 players. They were amazed that Malik Beasley fell to them at that point, and they felt obligated to take the pick. So, like, they went into that knowing that they weren't going to be able to take three players because of the money. So teams have to be thinking that way, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
Which is why Boston is probably going to trade one of
those
gonna
three
first rounders.
They're going to have to.
Yeah.
Especially if Gordon Hayward ends up re-upping with them, too.
Yeah.
So did I get a chance to bring up Detroit?
No, we haven't even talked Detroit yet.
No, because that's a team that I wrote about them yesterday for Forbes. I think that's a team that you should also look at over the next couple of years. Like, they are going to have a clean cap sheet. They have a somewhat functional young core. They don't have a star. They don't have this one guy you can build around, but they should have a top five pick. Like, they have all their opportunities to go at this rebuilding project from different avenues. They can go the Hinkie special route. Like, they can go sign under the radar young players. They can go out and take on bad contracts. They can get creative with their salary cap structure. So, yeah, I mean, lots of flexibility there as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what they do.
Are there any other big lessons that either of you guys want to hit on in terms of what teams should or should not do?
One last thing. If Jamal Murray does not become the player he is, all of this talk about the Nuggets having the best rebuild in the past two decades goes away. It's that easily falls apart. That's what people need to realize, too, is that, yes, it's a long process to get to this point, and you make one wrong decision, and it just collapses in your hands.
Yeah,
I wonder if they should have let him go to restricted
agency. Well, I don't think it should have gone that far. I know for a fact the Nuggets were terrified of the Gordon Hayward situation in Utah. Terrified of it.
Yeah.
That was a big part. And I was told they knew he wasn't going to be a max player this year and probably not next year. They are investing in understanding that he is a workaholic who will get better. So they weren't making this bet for now. They were making it for 2 years from now.
Did they have a sit down with the owner? To where they made him pledge that he's going to get better, like Andrew Wiggins.
It's like a form contract that he signs and dates, and like a notary stamps. No. The Nuggets don't.
I will
do
get
that
at least 10% better every year. I promise.
You will see my points per game go up by 0.2% every four games. Don't worry.
No,
Nuggets don't do stuff like that. Tim Connelly is the beautiful mind type who might have a whiteboard with a lot of beautiful organization, and then an idea pops into his head, and he's just like rapidly erasing and scribbling stuff that you can't read, and it looks like hieroglyphics. So, like, no, they don't operate like that. They're very much so different than that.
Yeah, but to your point, I mean, like, we talked about Fultz and Tobias Harris. Like, those were two decisions where... You know, the Sixers, and I would even throw in Jahlil Okafor there, too. Like, those are three things where that just changed. Each single decision changed the trajectory of their rebuild, and each mistake is proving incredibly costly right now.
Yeah, so, and what happened to the Nuggets trade Gary Harris for Kevin Love, Paul Millsap never comes to Denver, it all stops. It's the same decision, and they just happen to make the alternate one. It's that close every time.
Yeah. Don't try to be an NBA GM.
It's hard, man. People don't realize how hard that is. Ooh, what a job.
Yeah.
So one final note. You know, some listeners are probably going to sit here and say, well, what kind of rebuilding process is the right one? And I think there's a pretty clear answer to that. If you win a championship, you've done it the right way.
Yes, thank you for that. I was going to say there's not one right answer. Only right answer is getting to where you need to be. However you get there, it's like playing Survivor. Whatever you can do to get to that last point so you have a chance. That's all that you can control. Yeah. Do everything in your power to get there.
I will say this much, though. I don't think a championship necessarily... I don't think every successful rebuilding process will end in a championship.
Of course not.
Like, a championship should not determine whether a rebuild was successful. But, yeah, if you win a title, then who gives a damn?
The Clippers, with the most bizarre rebuild ever of just, like, we're going to sign all these guys around Blake Griffin, that worked. Yeah. Whether or not people want to, like, talk about how stale it got or how much of an asshole Chris Paul, I don't care. It worked. They were there.
Yeah.
And they were as close as anybody can get. And I think now we can say the Nuggets worked. I think we can also say the 76ers worked. They won 50-plus games. This was the goal, was to be there. And they got there.
Yeah.
So did the Rockets work?
The Rockets did work, and then their ownership changed. That's really as simple as it is.
Can you tell that to Rockets fans, though? We really have to just drive that point home to Rockets fans, because they are almost suicidal at not winning that damn
league. Yeah, well, Rockets fans hate me enough as it is. Just be happy with a transcendental offensive player, and please stop yelling in my mentions for just 5 minutes, please. That's all I ask for.
Well, on that note, I'm going to ask you, TJ, to plug your Twitter account one more time so you can let Rockets fans know where to hit you up.
Rockets fans, if you want to come hate me, you can find me at TJ McBride NBA on Twitter. I am tweeting too much as usual. And then again, subscribe to the Rocky Mountain Hoops podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Go to MileHighSports.com and read about college and all kinds of other Colorado sports, I guess.
Good stuff. Well, thanks as always, TJ, for coming on. This was a lot of fun. Thank you all to listening as always. Hope you're staying safe out there. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. And we are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen and our special guest, TJ McBride. Have a good weekend, guys.
You too, Brian. And you know what, guys? My all-time team was still better.
Wrong. Wrong.
Keep telling yourself that, Morten.
Mm-hmm. I will.